You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Kai Wright, host of WNYC's United States of Anxiety. I'm in for Tanzina Vega, who's back later this week.
This is heartbreaking. It's a very emotional issue for a lot of people, and it's very difficult and challenging. And obviously, these TBP facilities are not made for kids.
They said they've never seen so many unaccompanied children holding hands and walking up to them with nobody in sight. Could you ever envision that of your children?
There are not that many options. So the options are, and we have a lot of critics, but many of them are not putting forward a lot of solutions.
In contrast to his predecessor, President Joe Biden promised to establish an immigration system that was empathetic to asylum seekers. But a surge of unaccompanied minors along the U.S.-Mexico border is putting an early strain on the Biden administration's approach to immigration. Unlike former President Trump, Biden is no longer using a health order to expel unaccompanied children arriving at the southern border. It's been reported that as of this weekend, there are 4,200 teens and children in detention facilities meant for adults. In an attempt to alleviate overcrowding, the Biden administration announced last weekend that the president has directed FEMA to expedite the processing of migrant children at the border. FEMA is also being deployed to provide minors with shelter, food, and proper medical attention. But some Democrats, including Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota, have spoken out against the conditions at the facilities in which minors are being housed, while some Republicans have blamed the Biden administration's policies for the spike in unaccompanied minors. Understanding the situation at the border is where we start today. Let's talk with Hamid Ali Aziz, who is immigration reporter for BuzzFeed News. Hamid, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with why we're even seeing more accompanied minors arriving at the southern border right now. What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, you have a situation where, last week, President Biden's senior advisor at the border mentioned how after several years of a restrictive immigration policy that there appear to be, a pent-up hope for people at the border, hoping to gain protections in the U.S. And as we've seen, since the beginning of the administration, the number of unaccompanied children has only increased at the southern border.
And what, if anything, do you know about the kids who are arriving recently? Are they mainly teenagers or these young children?
Yeah, mostly teenagers. This is just a population that has continued to grow in the last several weeks. And like you said, I mean, they are in facilities at the border that are meant for adults.
Mm-hmm. And, there's a little bit of political debate about what drives children to migrate in the first place. But what do you know about why these kids and teens have left their home countries?
Well, I think we've seen that there have been issues in Central America regarding the economy, regarding natural disasters, regarding lack of good governance in certain areas, and thus far we haven't had an opportunity to speak to one of these unaccompanied children that have come since the beginning of the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. That's something that I think is important, is to figure out what they were looking for coming to America.
Yeah. The ways in which child migrants were held by the U.S. government during the Trump administration, as I mentioned, really drew widespread outrage. So what are the conditions of minors currently being held by Border Patrol and Health and Human Services? We know that there are 4,200 as of this weekend, but what are the conditions?
So attorneys who interviewed children at one facility at the southern border, a Border Patrol facility, said that the children told them that it was overcrowded, that they hadn't been outside in a while, and that, they were really seeking just to get back to their family members. These attorneys were quite concerned and really pushing for these children to be released from these Border Patrol stations. I mean, the issue we have right now is the Biden administration is really trying to clear this 4,200 unaccompanied children in Border Patrol stations and get them to these HHS facilities across the country that are, not overcrowded and that are, perhaps better prepared for caring for the children.
Can you explain the distinction there? So the rule, as I understand it, is that Border Patrol is supposed to transfer custody of minors within 72 hours to Health and Human Services. So how long are minors being held in these detention facilities that aren't meant to house children? And what is the distinction between those facilities and what happens when they go to HHS?
Sure. I mean, I'd seen data at the end of last week that over 100 children had been in these Border Patrol stations for 10 days or more. So that's obviously quite a bit past that 72-hour mark. The HHS facilities vary, but essentially they're better prepared to educate the children, to, you know, give them more space, to have people who are, you know, focused on working with minors. And obviously they've come under criticism in the past several years, and there have been a number of lawsuits. But I think right now the issue is the administration, I think, knows that, the DHS secretary said over the weekend that these stations are not meant for children. And so we need to get them out immediately.
Right. How many kids are coming every day? I mean, we know it's 4,200, but was there one big surge, or is this sort of a steady flow of kids? Because I imagine that matters in terms of how it's managed.
It varies, definitely, but they've seen days with several hundred unaccompanied children being apprehended. And so obviously you have a situation where several hundred coming in and Border Patrol trying to get children to HHS and not being able to match the number of children being taken in as to the number being transferred to HHS. Now, mm-hmm. The number of children in HHS custody has shot up as well. HHS is really trying everything they can to find more space. I mean, the number of children in their custody has jumped from 8,200 as of last week to 9,200 as of Sunday. They've created this emergency intake site in Midland, Texas, to take in some children, to get them out of these overcrowded stations. And they're looking at opening up a Dallas Convention Center as well to take in some workers.
And the Biden administration is going to deploy the Federal Emergency Management Agency, as we've said, to the southern border to help with this processing. What does that mean for how quickly this can happen, or at least how quickly the children can be moved to facilities that are appropriate for them?
I think it's just another way for them to support HHS and Border Patrol in finding, shelter for these unaccompanied children, finding, places for them to be other than these Border Patrol stations. The DHS secretary has already sought volunteers from across the agency, employees from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the agency that oversees asylum claims and the legal immigration system. They've actually been sent an email as of late last week seeking volunteers to help HHS, if they want to be working at the HHS facilities with children, helping these children to figure out, who their sponsors are in the U.S. and vetting them. So it really does feel like an all-hands-on-deck situation.
Mm-hmm. I mean, do you get a sense that the administration predicted this? President Biden did campaign on reversing some of former President Trump's hardline immigration policies, including this very thing, this idea of what happens to minors who show up at the border. So was this surge something that you get a sense that the White House saw coming, or were they caught by surprise?
It is hard to say definitively. I mean, advocates have said that they'd warn the Biden administration that a increase in numbers of children would be seen after they stop turning them around at the border like the Trump administration did. But obviously, it didn't work because their plans didn't work because the stations obviously have become overwhelmed and overcrowded.
Yeah, certainly senior Republican officials, including former President Trump, have often used this issue as part of their politics. And some Republicans have said they blamed the Biden administration for the surge. Is there any, they say that, his announcement of immigration reform urged people to begin migrating. Is there any truth to that? Do you have a sense that there's any truth to that?
Right. I mean, we'd been seeing an increase in unaccompanied children, for several months now. Obviously, it's been higher in the last 2 months. But it's always obviously people, like Biden's advisor said, that there had been this pent-up hope. But to connect surges with U.S. policy can be sometimes a tricky equation. So I think at this point, you know, we'll have to see how the next few months go.
Can you remind us of President Trump's Remain in Mexico policy? What was that policy, and what did it mean for the safety of people who were seeking asylum?
So under the Trump administration, this was actually one of their solutions, their key policy measures to stop the increase in number of people at the border. In 2019, there was a really high number of families showing up at the southern border, and the Trump administration doubled down on sending people to Mexico to stay there for the duration of their asylum cases that were processing through immigration courts. So there's more than 70,000 people that were kept there, and advocates reported that they were facing, you know, extortion, kidnapping, you know, violent crimes. And, you know, it was a really perilous situation for them. And what the Biden administration did was immediately stop that policy, stop putting people into that, program. And actually in the last several weeks have allowed some of those people to enter the U.S. slowly. There's been around 1,500 that have been able to enter the U.S. and to, seek their asylum claims in the U.S.
And how does that, if at all, relate to the unaccompanied minors situation at the border? Are they separate issues, or was this part of it?
So this is separate in a way. Unaccompanied children up until early February were being turned around under this public health order that the Trump administration had in place as of last March. Now, you know, what happened in the fall is a federal judge actually blocked the policy and said, you know, it violated federal law. But in February, early February, an appeals court came back and said that the Biden administration, if they wanted to, they could actually continue to turn around children. They stayed the federal court's decision, and the Biden administration decided not to. And since then, we've seen this steady increase in unaccompanied children and the backup in the Border Patrol stations.
Hamed Ali-Aziz is immigration reporter for BuzzFeed News. Hamed, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yesterday, Deb Haaland made history when she was confirmed as the Secretary of the Department of the Interior. Secretary Haaland is a citizen of the Laguna Puebla and is not just the first Native American to lead the Interior Department, but the first Native cabinet secretary of any sort in U.S. history. Here she is last month during her confirmation hearing.
I believe we all have a stake in the future of our country, and I believe that every one of us, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, shares a common bond. Our love for the outdoors and a desire and obligation to keep our nation livable for future generations. I carry my life experiences with me everywhere I go. It's those experiences that give me hope for the future. If an Indigenous woman from humble beginnings can be confirmed as Secretary of the Interior, our country holds promise for everyone.
Secretary Haaland was elected to the House of Representatives in 2018, and she served as one of the first two Native American women elected to Congress. Now she will serve as head of the Interior Department, which oversees public lands and Indian affairs. Many Republicans opposed Haaland's nomination, mostly for her positions on climate change and fossil fuels. For more on her confirmation, I'm joined by Julian Brave Noisecat, the Vice President of Policy and Strategy for Data for Progress. Julian, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Regina Lopez White Skunk, a Ute Mountain Ute tribal member and former co-chair of Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. Regina, thanks for being here.
No problem. It's a great honor.
So, Julian, you have been quite vocal in your support for Deb Haaland for this position. Can you walk us through your thoughts on why this will mean something?
I think to understand the significance of Haaland's confirmation, you have to understand the history of the Interior Department and what it has done to Native people. So the third Interior Secretary, a man named Alexander Stewart, described the United States mission as to, quote, civilize or exterminate Native people. And throughout its history, the Interior Department has played a leading role in that attempted assimilation and annihilation of Native nations and people, whether it be through the implementation of the Dawes Act in the late 1800s, which privatized and alienated millions of acres of Native land, through the kidnapping of children who were taken away to boarding schools where our languages and cultures were often quite literally beaten out of us, or through the era of termination in the mid-1900s from the 40s to the 60s, when the stated policy of the United States was to, quote, terminate Native nations and our legal status. And against that history, the nomination of a Laguna Pueblo woman who, you know, at her first Senate confirmation hearing before the Energy and Natural Resource Committee, you know, came speaking her Karis language, you know, acknowledged that the hearing was taking place on the territory of the Piscataway people, is a more remarkable shift. You know, Holland went to the camps, erected the path of the Dakota Access Pipeline, and cooked green chili stew and tortillas for the water protectors. And I think that the juxtaposition of her presence and leadership with, you know, the deep and very harmful history of the Interior Department of the United States just says all you need to know about why this is so significant.
Regina, what do you think that shift will be that Julian's talking about there in the relationship between the federal government and indigenous communities now? On a practical level, what will that shift be?
Well, as we all know, when any of our leaders visit Washington, D.C., and I think it's typical of any group that visits Washington, D.C., either you're granted a 30-minute meeting. If you're lucky, you may get an hour. And usually half of that time spent is recapping history, recapping the historical traumas. With having Deb Haaland there, now we can get down to business maybe 15 to 30 minutes a little earlier and really start about some of the issues. And you know, it's rather, we take it lighthearted sometimes, but, you know, it really does put a little stent in some of the goals and trying to get down to business. And I can remember many times upon visits when our tribal leadership would go into Washington, D.C. It's rather surprising how many people are very unaware of a lot of the history and the current issues that many of the tribal nations face today.
And what is that business? What is the business you hope to see Secretary Haaland prioritize on a policy level?
On a policy level, I think to continue to elevate the level of consultation. Many times consultation is one of the most lightly taken within agencies and for organizations that work with tribal nations. It is not a mere check on the box on the form that you're filling out. It is an obligation. It's also the accountability upon the federal government to ensure that this happens, because tribes as federally recognized groups have that sovereignty and voice that get to enjoy that government-to-government conversation, which gets taken very lightly. Mm-hmm. I think that'll be one huge, huge step in an entirely different direction, which historically gets taken very lightly or falls by the wayside.
Right. Julian, you spoke with Secretary Haaland last year. What about you? What are some changes you foresee her bringing to the Interior Department?
Yeah, so I completely agree with what the councilwoman just said. And, you know, I think that one thing that I'm very excited about is that over the last 10 years, you know, we have seen at the grassroots level a number of movements arise that have shown indigenous peoples, you know, leading on in issues of environmental justice and environmentalism and conservation. You know, if you think about the No DAPL movement at Standing Rock that I mentioned before, the No Keystone XL movement, you know, the movement that the councilwoman helped lead to protect bear's ears. You know, there's a theme of indigenous people standing up and speaking for protection of the environment, protection of the air that we breathe, the water that we drink, you know, the fish that we rely on, all of that. And, you know, I think that Haaland's leadership in the Congress on those issues is well known among, you know, environmentalists and activists and Native people. And I think that her elevation now to the cabinet, you know, signals that grassroots leadership is being recognized at the highest levels of government. And I'm very hopeful that Holland will, you know, be able to combine those things, you know, the sovereignty and rights of Native nations and the imperative to protect and preserve the environment and our climate for future generations.
Julian, what do you think? I guess most people don't really understand, I believe most people don't really understand what the Interior Department does in the first place. Can we back up and just sort of give us an idea of what it is that the Secretary is going to oversee?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Interior Department is a sprawling bureaucracy that oversees a fifth of the nation's landmass and waters. It also manages a great deal of natural resources and the nation-to-nation relationship with the 574 federally recognized tribes across the country. So it's a quite wide-ranging department, and I think it's worth adding to that context, not just the history that I mentioned before of Interior's role in the colonization and theft of lands and resources from Native people, but the more recent history under the Trump administration. You know, the Interior Department was significantly, I'd say, tampered with. You know, the Bureau of Land Management, for example, was relocated to Grand Junction, Colorado, which led many lifelong civil servants to leave the agency. There was a fire sale of leases to drill for oil and gas on public lands at the end of the Trump administration, and there were countless rules that were messed with or rolled back or changed. And so, you know, the Interior Department is this big sprawling bureaucracy that was, you know, significantly injured over the last 4 years, and that is the context that Madam Secretary Holland is now stepping in to lead.
Regina, what does her confirmation mean for Indigenous women in particular throughout the U.S.?
Historically, just straight across the board, women have faced a lot of challenges in no matter what area they choose to go into. As an Indigenous woman, sometimes we're up against different cultures and traditional beliefs. Many of the Southwestern tribes, they don't believe in traditionally installing females into leadership, especially within their own cultural realms. So when we decide to take that big jump and pursue a voice in politics, sometimes it takes a little bit to convince our elders and to convince people that have real stern beliefs in the cultural ways that this is something that could help our people. So there's many challenges we have to overcome. And I'm just going to share a real quick experience that I had serving as the only female member amongst the other four tribes of the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. I had a representative from the Pueblo Ozuni and the Hopi tribe, whom at some point I realized traditionally these individuals don't normally deal with a female in leadership. And that really took me for a moment. And so I had to consult with my father and one of my grandmothers and asked. And I was very, very fearful of what my next steps were going to be. And they advised me to sit down with the gentleman and just put it on the table and ask. And that would help me determine what my next steps would be. Would I continue working as a leader within the group, or would I step aside and, for the betterment of the movement, allow for a male member represent our tribal voice? And I was really happy. The outcome was nothing what I expected. I was very gracious to continue on, which they assured me that, you know, times are changing, and even within our culture and ceremonies, there's always a position for a female, the motherly figure, who has that caring, kind-hearted, gentle way about things, but yet knows when to be stern.
Regina Lopez Whiteskunk is Ute Mountain Ute tribal member and former co-chair of Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. Julian Brave Noisecat is vice president of policy and strategy at Data for Progress. Julian, Regina, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my honor.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we've also invited Secretary Holland on the show to chat with us. We are looking forward to having her on.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Saturday marked 1 year since Breonna Taylor was shot and killed by police in Louisville, Kentucky. Members of Taylor's family and local activists gathered in the city's downtown this weekend to honor her life, renewing calls for police reform and accountability. None of the officers involved in her killing have been charged in connection to her death. While the police killing of Taylor and others spurred a racial reckoning last summer, these high-profile deaths have also had a serious toll on the mental health of many Black people in this country. For more on this racial trauma, we're joined by Dr. Miriam Jernigan Noesi, licensed psychologist and professor of psychology at Agnes Scott College, and Dr. Carlton E. Green, licensed professional psychologist and director of diversity training and education at the University of Maryland. Carlton and Miriam, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Carlton, can we start in most basic terms here? How do we define racial trauma?
Sure. We're talking about the emotional and psychological response to racial incidents, especially by people of color, that are oftentimes unexpected. Their experience is threatening, and they can result really in significant psychological distress. We're talking too about sort of like this cumulative effect that people have across their across the course of their lifetime as a result of not only experiencing small t types, small racial incidents, but also thinking in terms of the larger history of racism that's impacted the experiences of people of color in this country. And so it leads not only to sort of like a momentary stress that people experience, but also it could be a lifetime of stress or sort of like this insidious chronic stress that comes along with being targeted.
Miriam, what are some common ways that racial trauma manifests? I know I'm sort of constantly wondering, is this racial trauma I'm experiencing right now when I'm feeling something? What does it feel like?
Sure. I think, our research tells us that there are a variety of experiences that individuals have. I mean, we as psychologists tend to pay attention to things like experiences where folks report maybe re-experiencing a particular event. So if there was a direct incident of racism or racial harassment or discrimination that occurred, they tend to sort of think about the event constantly. In other cases, you have individuals that will report, you know, what we call somatic symptoms. So whether those are body aches, in addition to, you know, experiencing headaches. In addition to that, for some folks, they may also experience difficulties with what we call executive functioning. So that's our memory, that's decision making. So there's an impact to the brain, in essence, the neurobiology for individuals, where the demand that's placed on the body and the brain with as a result of the experience of racial trauma, racial discrimination, can really lead to an overload. And that, in essence, compromises the ability for an individual to maybe focus on work or at school, if it's a younger individual or emerging adult that may be in an educational environment, as well as, I said, memory and kind of other things related to executive functioning.
Yeah. Carlton, we're focusing primarily on Black people in the U.S. for this conversation, but racial trauma is experienced by people of color across the board. Is that right?
I would certainly agree with that, especially as we see the rise of anti-Asian sentiment across the country. I would imagine that there are plenty of our Asian and Asian American siblings who are also experiencing these symptoms. I remember giving presentations or talking to folks, especially when COVID arised in this country. You were hearing stories about Asian folks being harassed as they were standing on the street waiting for a bus to come, or people being accused of being sort of like carrying the virus in their bodies. Yeah. When we think about racial trauma, we are talking about people being demeaned or having sort of like these being discriminated against or harassed because of their skin color. So it would really apply to all of the minoritized racial groups in the United States.
Carlton, when it comes to police killing specifically, I wonder about the source of the trauma. You know, does it come from seeing the photos, watching the videos, reading the coverage? I refuse to watch the videos, for instance. I feel like I'm protecting myself in that way. But is it that, or is it more than that?
Well, I think it's probably a little bit more than that. I mean, certainly watching the videos and taking in all of the images or taking in the news or looking at your timeline and being activated by those, by the messages that you're receiving there certainly contributes to the trauma. The writing of the paper that Dr. Jernigan Noesi led us in was really related to that. And back in 2015, when we were seeing all of the images that were so prevalent across the news media and the social media. But there's also a way of thinking about this as being connected to the history of racial violence and discrimination that has been visited upon the bodies of people of color across time, right? If I go back to the example of our Asian American siblings, there's a history of Asian American and Asian folks in this country being labeled as dirty or filthy or seen as unclean. And so we are seeing now that history resurfacing, and people are again associating that particular population and treating them in very inhumane ways as a result of the history that has been taught about that particular group of people.
I wonder, Miriam, how does this manifest? We talked about the ways it manifests in our bodies and our emotions. I wonder about anger in particular, because I know that is something, you know, again, I have struggled with. What about carrying anger about this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that we want to, and again, as folks who are thinking about racial trauma and who have been for some time, I think the way to think about this as, you know, a response to a distressing situation, in particular, that results in an emotional injury. And so for individuals, how they respond based on, you know, a particular incident or just exposure to experiences, you know, of discrimination or racism may vary for some folks. Certainly, though, based on research, anger is one of the experiences for individuals that has been reported relative to certain experiences of racial discrimination. And I think what's critically important for Carlton and I is that folks are aware of the fact that anger can be present, but also the validation of the anger. Again, if we sort of reconceptualize or rethink, you know, racial trauma as a response to racism, it makes sense that an individual would be upset. And I think what contributes to that anger, though, according to our research, is that experiences of racism and racial discrimination are often sudden, they're uncontrollable. And for many individuals, right, not being able to predict when an incident might happen or exposure to racism might happen, as well as the inability to really control whether or not it will happen again, can lend itself to some individuals experiencing anger. The other, I think, less commonly discussed consequence, though, is also the internalization of racism for some individuals that can lead to shame and guilt and low self-esteem. And I think that's not often emphasized enough, and especially as a mental health professional, if you're not well-trained and you're working with individuals, something that individuals may miss out on or at least see, maybe perhaps relative to other presenting concerns, is the shame and the guilt that's also associated with racial trauma.
Well, and on that score, what do we do about it? It's such a haunting idea that we'll turn these feelings on ourselves in some ways. Carlton, what are techniques for dealing with it as individuals and as a society?
Yeah, I mean, I would just want to follow up on what Miriam was saying there about anger, because that might be a really good place to start and think about, right? We have learned across the ages that anger is really a source of energy and a source of creativity. So we have to acknowledge that we are angry, that we are being hurt, that we have been harmed, right? That is really the first piece. For so many of us, we are taught to not necessarily acknowledge that we are experiencing something that could be debilitating for us with regards to racism. And so that's where we start. You want to start by acknowledging. The next piece for me is to be thinking about, and I'll invite Miriam into this as well, to be thinking in terms of how do you shift into connecting with the sources of racial pride that have been useful for you across your lifetime. Racial pride is really one of the primary antidotes to being able to resist and heal from racism or racial trauma. And so connecting with your ancestors, be that through history, or if there are ways to connect through music, or thinking about religious communities that you connect through that also feed your sense of racial pride, there's got to be a way of leaning into that in particular that feels really healing for people. I often tell folks too, you know, with Miriam talking about the physiological effects, that you also have to move your body. We're talking about a stress that is setting into your body. And what we know is that stress is probably most easily counteracted by moving your body and also by meditating. Those pieces have been proven in research to be useful. So one of the things that also I think is really important is that we are talking about stress. And so for a lot of us, we don't think in terms of experiencing heightened levels of hypervigilance or cortisol in our bodies. And so you have to work that out of your body in order to be able to move towards some type of healing for yourself.
Miriam, what about you? How do you respond to that question? And also, how do we identify when it's happening?
I mean, I think the key piece, and Carlton noted, you know, mindfulness and deep breathing as being one way. It's about facilitating awareness. So taking the time to be still, to acknowledge what it is that we're experiencing. And I would like to underscore that, as opposed to thinking about this as something that we attempt to address on an individual basis, there's power in sort of being in a collective space. So encouraging individuals to, you know, be alongside other folks that are supportive and in a sense of community can be really healing and facilitate healing for individuals. Racism doesn't happen. It certainly happens, can happen to individuals, but it happens to communities. And so in that regard, we tend to promote healing through community as well.
And how does the community as a whole heal?
I think over time, I mean, as we talk about race and racism, right, the key piece, for the fundamental piece for me that's missing, and in 2020 this shifted a little bit, is that there's a consistent lack of acknowledgement with regard to the experiences of racism that people of color experience. And so again, going back to that starting point of just awareness and ensuring, you know, that individuals are very clear, not that in addition to racism existing, but also thinking about how it impacts individuals, is where I think for communities as well could be really powerful.
Dr. Miriam Jernigan-Noesi is a licensed psychologist and professor of psychology at Agnes Scott College. And Dr. Carlton E. Green is a licensed professional psychologist and director of diversity training and education at the University of Maryland. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you for having
Thank
us.
You.
And if you or someone you know is struggling or having thoughts of suicide, you can call the NAMI hotline at 800-950-NAMI. That's 6264, or the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. It's The Takeaway. I'm Kai Wright, in for Tanzina. Last week, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who has been accused of sexual harassment by 7 women, responded to growing demands for his resignation.
People know the difference between playing politics, bowing to cancel culture, and the truth. Let the review proceed. I'm not going to resign. I was not elected by the politicians. I was elected by the people.
Cuomo is one in a long line of politicians and celebrities who have invoked the idea of cancel culture as a defense against allegations of misconduct. In recent weeks, English television personality Piers Morgan blamed cancel culture for his departure from Good Morning Britain. And fans of longtime reality TV host Chris Harrison are pointing to cancel culture after he stepped away from his role on The Bachelor. It's a phrase that has been used so much and so widely, it's starting to feel sort of meaningless. So we wanted to hear your thoughts on cancel culture.
I think cancel culture is just another overblown for dramatic effect way of getting attention and making us more divided. After all, the Dixie Chicks were canceled back in the early aughts by the very people who are seriously whining about cancel culture today. And wasn't Colin Kaepernick canceled? I'm using air quotes around all of the canceled words here.
This is Dallas Miller in Portland, Oregon, and I think cancel culture is mostly at this point slang. It's a lot of manufactured outrage. Really, the ideology that we need to be using is accountability. Most people that find themselves quote-unquote canceled have earned that themselves.
It's crazy how these things become part of our lexicon, you know? But it's just an elaborate wordplay. It's Orwellian. It's a way for demagogues to escape defending a wrong-headed point of view. They can just say, oh, you're canceling me. I'm not canceling you. I'm just disagreeing with you.
For more on what this phrase cancel culture really means, I'm joined by Meredith Clark, an assistant professor at the University of Virginia's Department of Media Studies. Meredith, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start by defining terms here. How do you define the phrase cancel culture?
Well, the way that cancel culture is being used now, I see as a useful means of conflating accountability and public opinion and the news cycle, frankly, to dismiss often credible complaints or grievances from people who otherwise might not have an opportunity to make petition in a way that matters.
And where did this originate? You note people who might not have an opportunity to petition in a way that matters. That's part of the roots of this idea, right?
Absolutely. So canceling someone, the act of canceling someone, is language that was used primarily in Black queer communities to express disapproval, to divest from someone, a person, place, or an idea. And as it's mashed up in cancel culture, it indicates an omission of some of the actual cultural context via its appropriation.
And so, and it's obviously then become part of these broader culture wars. What's its role now in this broader culture war conversation?
Exactly. You nailed it, as did so many of your listeners. The phrase cancel culture is sort of like that terminology that harkens back to the Southern strategy and Southern politics from Nixon to Reagan, right? So instead of being able to say out and out what you're talking about, especially if it has racist or racial connotations, you use a different phrase. So instead of talking about welfare programs and really job theft, as some people thought of it, you talk about affirmative action. Rather than talking about ghettos and barrios, you talk about the inner city. And so there's so many ways that political elites and media elites find terms that they can use that do the heavy lifting for them of signaling to their groups while also creating an other of a group that they disagree with.
So that it becomes this coded language. And it's so interesting that you trace its origins to Black queer communities. And then it ultimately is something that a governor of New York accused of sexual misconduct would then pull on to save himself. That's such an interesting etymological journey that this phrase has traveled.
That's the impact of social media and the overlap between journalists on social media and those underrepresented communities in news media. So you've got people who are listening to neighborhoods of folks that they ultimately wouldn't have the opportunity to come in contact with or would not seek out as experts. And they're taking that language, repurposing it, and using it in ways that communicate it to a broader American public. We've got social media to thank for the rise of so-called cancel culture.
But let's talk about some of the actual ideas here. So some people think that you should be calling people in. That's the phrase people use, call people in, contact them directly, rather than calling people out publicly online. Do you agree with that, or is that even the right way to talk about it?
Well, I think that it's a useful phrase, and I think it's a useful idea, but we have to recognize what power dynamics are at play. To call someone in means that you have to have an existing relationship with them, and that that person has to respect you. I can't call the governor of New York and say, you know, Governor Cuomo, here's where you're wrong about this. He doesn't care about what I have to say. I'm not a voter in New York. I'm not a public figure. I'm not another politician. So that doesn't work. And it's very limited, the idea of calling someone in. Mm-hmm. So we've got to come up with something else that works, public accountability.
And so what is the distinction between cancel culture as it's being discussed and accountability? And why do they get conflated?
So they get conflated because it's useful to powerful people for them to be conflated. When we talk about cancel culture, we really need to pay good attention to that word culture. Culture in 2014 was a word that Merriam-Webster chose as word of the year because there were so many people looking it up. Mm. And I find it interesting that they say that culture conveys a kind of academic attention to systematic behavior, and really importantly here, allows us to isolate an idea, an issue, or group. So anytime someone uses the word culture to describe something, you want to pay attention. That's a bit of a red flag.
Yeah. But it is the case that, you know, so many people outside of these elite circles have sort of taken in this idea of cancel culture as a threat, as something that is dangerous, and has devolved our public discourse, even amongst friends, in private circles. I mean, how do you think about that? What do you say to folks who feel that way?
Well, I think at its very base level, what the idea of cancel culture appeals to is our sense of belonging and our need for belonging. So whether we are everyday people who are going to work, we're not in the public eye, or whether we are celebrities who have money to lose or politicians who have influence to lose, We all have a fear of losing our sense of belonging. And that is what politicians, celebrities, and other public figures are playing on when they invoke cancel culture. If I can be canceled, so can you. And the risk is simply not the same.
Mm-hmm. Because of the difference in power dynamics.
Absolutely.
I want to get your response to something that was brought up by one of our callers.
This is Lynn in San Antonio, Texas. I think that the trend of cancel culture simplifies complex issues and makes public figures want to simply toss out an apology without actually digging into the meat of the issue and really doing the uncomfortable growth that is required to become a better person.
How do you respond to what Lynn had to say?
I think Lynn has made a sage and astute point. I think this is exactly the problem, but it's not only politicians who need to do that investigating. It's also journalists who need to think about discernment and whether they quote politicians who are using the phrase cancel culture and how they frame that use. The public is relying on journalists to make the translation between the language that politicians and other public figures use and what it means for us in our everyday life. And for those in positions of power who use that phrase, it is a protectant. It keeps them from having to investigate themselves and look and see what they have to lose, how they stand to benefit from using this term, and why they use it in the first place.
One defense that people often pull out when they criticize cancel culture is the importance of free speech. Here's what one of our callers had a thought on that as well.
This is Kate from Harrisonburg, Virginia. I think the right wing has always been fine with cancel culture, with everything from McCarthyism to the Dixie Chicks to books banned in our public libraries. They only complain about it now that they're facing consequences for bigotry. It really should be looked at as consequence culture and not cancel culture. We may have the freedom of speech in America, but we don't have the freedom from social consequences to our bigotry.
Consequence culture. I kind of like that. What do you make of that?
I love it. And I want to say thanks to Kate from Over the Mountain in Harrisonburg for coming up with that turn of phrase, because digital accountability practice, as I've called it, just doesn't have the same ring. But consequence culture, everyone immediately understands what consequences are. Culture just signifies that we are using this broad term to talk about what's happening when people call for accountability.
How do you think we move forward from here? All these terms are being thrown around. People are carrying so much emotional weight with them. They're being manipulated by politicians and others who have power. What do you think could help us move forward in a productive way?
I'll go back to the idea of journalistic discernment. As a journalist myself, I really do place the onus on journalists to do the work of unpacking, of translating, of being very clear about these terms. Journalists are intermediaries between public figures, between government figures, and the public. And they are the ones who have the ability to frame the narrative in a specific way, to present the narrative so that people have the opportunity to see what is real and what is spin. I really want news journalists, news media journalists to take on some responsibility there and not simply repeat this term.
Meredith Clark is an assistant professor at the University of Virginia's Department of Media Studies. Meredith, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
This is Lynn in San Antonio, Texas. I think that the trend of cancel culture simplifies complex issues and makes public figures want to simply toss out an apology without actually digging into the meat of the issue and really doing the uncomfortable growth that is required to become a better person.
This is Denise McQuinn, Dallas, Texas. Cancel culture is a ridiculous term manufactured by right-wing pundits and politicians to describe any change they feel threatened by, not to mention they project onto others exactly what they are doing. Remember Freedom Fries? Their lies are so tiresome. Intelligent people see right through their tactics.
The term cancel culture has been invented to cover for the consequences that happen following specific actions. We can have a conversation about how far back in time an action that has taken place should generate current consequences. But in truth, the whole idea of cancel culture is simply a way to attack those who want to see consequences for specific bad behavior.
This is Kate from Harrisonburg, Virginia. I think the right wing has always been fine with cancel culture, with everything from McCarthyism to the Dixie Chicks to books banned in our public libraries. It really should be looked at as consequence culture and not cancel culture. We may have the freedom of speech in America, but we don't have the freedom from social consequences to our bigotry.
That's all we have for you today. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Kai Wright, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.